If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to execute the ailing 78-year-old Bunton by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, plus an extended interview taped with Bunton last month on death row. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Yancy Valdades, and special guest Philip Scardino, a Houston attorney who handles death penalty cases. The Execution Watch for Carl Bunton begins.
Hello. This is Thursday, April 21st, 2022 edition of Execution Watch, your regularly scheduled program. R&B Gold Show with Charles Hightower on KPFT Houston is being preempted to bring you this important news. I'm Marlo Blue. We air this program live from the studios of Houston Media Source whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. Since 1982, when the federal moratorium on executions was lifted, Texas has executed 573 people. Tonight, the state will be lifting 78-year-old Carl Wayne Bunton out of his wheelchair, where he will be strapped onto a gurney and taken to his death. They plan to fill him full of drugs so lethal European countries explicitly won't allow the combination to be sold or exported for the purpose of human executions. Convicted in 1991 for the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Houston police officer James Irby during a traffic stop, Bunton has spent 30 years on Texas death row and was the oldest person there when a judge scheduled his April 21st execution date. Included in tonight's broadcast is an interview conducted by our legal analyst, Larry Douglas, and recorded by our associate and community partners, Houston Media Source TV. These interviews are often the last records of what the men and women on Texas's death row have to say. We do this to give the public a firsthand look at the person the prisoners have become and why the death penalty and maybe even life without parole really isn't the answer. Joining us to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Welcome, gentlemen. Mike Gillespie will be joining us by Zoom, and Larry is here in the studios. How did we get here, Larry? Tell us about this case.
Marlo, as you mentioned, this case dates back to 1990, quite a while ago. But it occurred in June of 1990 when Carl Bunton was confronted by a police officer. A traffic stop was made where Bunton was the passenger in the car. The officer was speaking to the driver of the car. Then the officer had the driver come around to the back of the car. They're talking together. Bunton, that the officer had spoken to briefly, gets out of the car, comes around, and then shoots the officer in the forehead. Officer falls to the ground, and Bunton shoots him twice more in the back. Then as he's trying to make his escape, he encounters a driver that he tries to hijack, and shoots at another person. Now, Bunton was found later on that day, and this was at a time, 1990, when the Harris County District Attorney's Office was pretty much perfecting its ability to handle and get convictions in capital murder cases.
Now, who was the district attorney during this period of time?
This was the middle of the Johnny Holmes reign. Johnny had been the DA, had been an assistant DA for 10 years, when in 1979 he became the DA, and he served in that role for 21 years, from 1979 to 2000. So 1990 was right in the middle. And this was a police officer who was killed by a person who had recently in his mid-40s, had spent much of his life in trouble, was out on parole for having committed a sexual assault case, and had said all kinds of things, like not having, reportedly having said things like, I'm not going to go back to jail if anything happens. We're just going to shoot it out right there. His brother had been shot by a police officer. He said, and there was some concern about he might have been trying to avenge his brother. But in any event, he killed the police officer, and the case is tried here in Harris County. The judges that he appeared before was Judge Bill Harmon. Harmon at the time was a fairly new judge, not totally new, but he was in the track of the way it worked then, and to some extent, to some extent today, but not as much. You became a judge in Harris County, criminal court judge, by making felony chief, and then after you make felony chief, then you get appointed judge. So he was there. He was a fairly young judge, and the case, because there was so much notoriety, was actually transferred, change of venue from Harris County. And Harris County has handled lots of police shooting cases before this and after this, but apparently the news was so there was so much news about the case that even Judge Harmon sees fit to move it to Gillespie County, which is in the Hill Country. But just to show you how the system was working, he was. The incident purportedly occurred around 7:45 at night. They indicted him the next day, June 27 and June 28. And they started jury selection in November the same year. So Harris County was, at that time, really fully engaged in the process of swift justice. So Judge Harmon appointed three lawyers to represent him. Now, sometimes people think that if the judge appoints the lawyers, that the lawyers are going to be in the judge's hip pocket. Nothing could be further from the truth. These guys fought Judge Harmon every step of the way, many times trying to get him removed from the case. And Judge Harmon, I don't know what it is about some people who can't resist the urge to speak when they really shouldn't speak. The role of the judge is to preside over the case in an objective fashion. And for whatever reason, he seemed to have tried a really decent case, but for whatever reason, Bill Harmon just kept saying things that he never should have said.
Let me interrupt you right now. As you know, this is a live TV show, and I'd like to go to our reporter who's actually outside of the Walls Union in Huntsville. As you had said earlier, we're talking, of course, to Ms. Yancy Balderas. Yancy, thank you. Can you tell us what's going on where you are?
Hi. Hi, everyone. We were out here at the Huntsville unit. The witnesses had just crossed and has gone inside. Mr. Carl Bunchen's witnesses walked after the media went in. And there's about 200 to 300 cops on the other side, I guess, waiting. And there are about a good 15 to 20 abolitionist people standing against this cruel and unusual punishment of Carl Bunchen. And this is a sad day in Texas, and we are reminding our law enforcement that could hear us here that execution is not the solution, and we are reminding them that we stand against this murder.
Now, Yancy, of course, our longtime reporters Linda Snyder and Danny Allen have been requested by Bunchen to be witnesses. Is there anyone else there from Carl Bunchen's family or support group that you've spoken with?
Yes, there is a friend of Carl's that walked in with our friend Linda and Danny, and there are some of her friends out here from Germany. There's people from France, and they are here They're here with Carl today.
Well, stand strong, Yancey, and I understand that this means that the execution is proceeding. Thank you so much. We will be back in touch with you.
We also did observe an ambulance go by. We could hear the mortars. We could hear the police mortars. Execution is not the solution! Execution is not the solution!
For those of you who don't know what's going on, the execution itself is taking place when the witnesses cross the road. That means that the execution has begun. We've been talking with our reporter from outside of Huntsville, outside of the walls unit, Miss Yancey Balderas, and...
It's very loud. It's about 300 cops out here.
There is a show of international support, and we thank everyone who is standing there in witness.
While
we have a moment, let's go back a little bit to speak with... a little bit more about what happened. What happened in the appeals process? Do we know? Is Philip Scardino with us yet?
No, not now.
All right. Let's continue on. So it was a very quick trial, and this was an unusual thing that's happened in the machine of Harris County.
Clearly Harris County was not delaying anything. They were moving swiftly to give Mr. Bunton a speedy trial. So the appeals were primarily surrounding the issues on appeal were primarily surrounding the thing that had occurred in trial, which the thing that the counsel tried to have Judge Harmon removed for, that is his conduct, his appearance of being biased. Judge Harmon said things, well, for one, he had a postcard of Judge Roy Bean, the hanging judge, you know, sitting right there on his on the bench. He made comments about he was doing God's work to get this matter resolved and get him executed. Made ex parte communications, that is, he was communicating with the DA's office, asking for the DA's office to provide advice, which judges did a whole lot of. He was having ex parte communications even with the defense lawyers. Now, these three defense lawyers who were appointed by him, they were all right there in Gillespie County together. Fairly small town, so they ran into each other from time to time. And the one time, I think Judge Harmon even went over to one of the lawyers' hotel rooms to talk about trying to smooth things over, because they really had a pretty battle, because they tried to have him removed, I think, three times based on his conduct and his appearances of impropriety. He did not discipline one of the bailiffs who walked in and said to the juror that the juror was looking very well dressed today. Looks like you are dressed to kill. It just happened over and over at the trial. And one of the things that this lawyer's tried to get in is that the mitigation evidence, because Bunton had had a pretty tough childhood in terms of poverty and abuse. And he was trying to get it in, and Judge Harmon was making all kinds of negative remarks about not only not letting it in, okay, about how improper it was to be let in, and even questioning cases in which courts had allowed it. And he said, well, those cases were decided wrongly. Well, it didn't get in. The mitigation, which is now the standard after Penring, you got to have mitigation. But the law was different then. Well, in 2012.
How so?
Well, now mitigation is really what saves a person's life. Okay, it's not just guilt, innocence. They do the offense, but now when it comes time to decide the fate, whether you give him the death penalty or not, okay, that is the continuous threat to society issue. Mitigation is now where the action really is in terms of trying to save a person's life and get the jury to decide on life in prison rather than the death penalty. Okay, and now that we've got life without parole, that's a real big difference too. But none of this was in effect at the time that Button's case was tried.
Right.
Now, but he did get back in 2012 and got to have that the mitigation evidence introduced, but he still got a life sentence. Still got the death sentence. So the system is working reasonably well. It's taken a lot of time. Nobody is delaying the process. As Judge Thomas has mentioned, that a defendant can't complain about being on death row for 30 years if during that 30 years he is exercising his legal rights to contest the conviction to begin with. And he was given all of his rights. It just took a while. It took the 30 years to get that done. Now that it's over, and the recent arguments that have been made in terms of not imposing the death penalty because he's been there for so long, those arguments the courts have found all the arguments he's making for the apparent delays have already been made before. They've been made before. We've examined them years ago. What it appears you're doing now, lawyers are doing now, is trying to delay the inevitable. So that's pretty much where the courts came out this time. Okay, when it came down to, do we get a stay to develop these issues? Court says those issues have been fully developed before. And if Mike wants to jump in at any time, I don't want to take the whole the time if Mike has.
Right, I'm not sure if we have Mike or if we have Clinton Young. I can't tell which one. Mike, do you have anything to add?
Not at this time.
Okay.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Marlo.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Yancy.
The mortars have stopped, and they are chanting. The cops are chanting. They're chanting. Still, the witnesses are inside, but I just heard them chant and yell in celebration.
Okay. Thank you, Yancy. Please let us know when the witnesses come back across. At this time, we need to go ahead and so that we can play in its entirety the interview that Larry Douglas did in Huntsville when he interviewed Carl Button in March. Now, as promised, we bring you that exclusive, uncut, and unedited interview with Mr. Carl Button.
Okay, are there any words that right now, without me asking any questions, that you'd just like to say?
No questions right now.
Great.
I understand everything.
Okay. Now, there has been some discussion about the fact that you are the oldest person in your position.
Yes, I'm the oldest man on death row.
Okay. How does that make you feel?
Old. As old as dirt. Yeah. I haven't been here the longest, you know, but age-wise, according to the Houston Chronicle, I'm the oldest guy on Texas death row.
So now the clarification is, although you might be the oldest here, you're not the person who's been here the longest.
No. I'm within maybe five or six of the oldest, but there's five or six that's still here that's been here longer than I have. Now, I've been locked up on this case here for 32 years, and since June the 27th of 1990, and there's people that's been here like 38 years. I mean, 35, you know, several people. But I'm within the maybe half a dozen of being the oldest that's been here.
So now, this oldest you're talking about, now you're talking about the length of time being here.
The person that's been here on death row the longest.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Age-wise, I'm the oldest. I'm 78. And so, but I haven't actually been here the longest.
So you've been here about 30 years.
Yeah, about 30, 31 years. Yeah.
Okay, and there are people who've been here longer than you.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, so that would make you how old when you came here?
Man, your math is better than mine.
You were in your 40s.
In my 40s, probably 45 or 46.
Okay, so you weren't a real young man when you got here.
Middle age,
okay. Just a thought. Is there anything that you have to say to a younger, middle-aged Carl Wayne Bunton that you've thought about since you've been here? Any advice you want to give to yourself?
Yes. Just like that Johnny Cash song, don't take your gun to town. Yeah. Leave your gun at home. Yeah. If you've got a gun, and you won't get in trouble. You know. If you've got a gun, you know. That would be my advice to myself. I wouldn't be here if I had left my gun at home.
Okay. Now, thinking back on just the reason that you got here, that is the trial and so forth. I understand you were tried in the 178th District Court, Harris County, Texas.
Yes, sir.
Judge Bill Harmon.
Yes.
Any comments on that at all, that experience?
That was a terrible experience. He was, at the time, in 1990, he was the youngest judge in Harris County, a young Republican judge. He came from a wealthy family. And he thought that he was God. He made the statement that he was doing God's work to see that I got executed. And that's just the way he ruled his courtroom, you know. And we had to deal with that all the time. I filed, and I don't know anything about the law, but I filed the first recusal motion while we were still trying to pick the jury. He was, because of this judge. I mean, he was just, I hope nobody ever gets him again. If he's still a judge, which I heard that he's a few years ago that he was a justice of the peace, that he wasn't a district judge anymore, state district judge, but somebody said that he was still a JP. So, I know anybody that went in his court, you know, I feel sorry for them.
Now you say at that point, Judge Harmon was one of the youngest judges?
Yes, he was a young Republican judge. He was the youngest judge in Houston in 1990. And he come from a wealthy family, and he just thought he could bend the rules and make up his own rules in his court. And that's what he did. My first appeal, my appeal attorneys filed like, I don't know, 73 or 83 grounds of error, my very first appeal. And about 90% of those grounds of error were directed at Judge Harmon. You know? And my two attorneys filed two additional recusal motions against Judge Harmon during the trial. And we couldn't get rid of him. I mean, you know, they'd stop the trial and bring in a visiting judge. And we couldn't get rid of him. We tried.
Now, one of the things Judge Harmon did was, I believe, that the trial was moved from Harris County.
Yes.
Because of the publicity.
Yes.
And moved to Fredericksburg.
Yes.
Okay. Did that make a difference at all to you?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, sure. Yeah, but that little town was selected by the district attorney at the time, John Holmes. The judge said, submit three towns for consideration for a change of venue. So we submitted San Antonio, Beaumont, Texas, and I think maybe Galveston or something, or Corpus Christi or something. And Johnny Holmes submitted one town, Fredericksburg, Texas. We found out during the trial, he brought his wife down there for vacation. They owned a little boutique shop in the town square there. That's why he wanted Fredericksburg to be the new location, and that the judge agreed with him. And in my recusal motion, the judge said in a public record, he said the reason he did not consider San Antonio was because of the large Hispanic population. Yeah, and I'm just paraphrasing now, but he said, in so many words, he said he did not think that the Mexicans had enough mental horsepower to keep up with a complicated capital murder trial. So what he was doing was excluding a whole class of citizens. And the Supreme Court said, hey, you can't do that. He admitted in open court he did.
And now who did that now?
Judge Harmon. Yeah. I filed a recusal motion to get rid of him. So they had to bring in the Court of Criminal Appeals appointed a retired judge to come in to hear the recusal motion because the judge was called as a witness. My two attorneys were called as a witness. They had to appoint me a new attorney for that purpose, for that hearing. There was a Mexican, a Hispanic attorney from San Antonio. He was there in Fredericksburg that day representing another client. So they appointed him. And when he heard that, he told Judge Harmon, he said, I'm a Mexican. He said, I'm from San Antonio. I think I could understand a complicated capital murder trial. It's all public record. And he objected to what the judge said, which is, according to the rules of law, that's what you got to do anytime somebody makes a statement like that, like a judge. And he objected to it, and it was in my appeal.
Okay. Now, just to clarify, Judge Harmon did leave the district court bench, and he did become a county court judge. And now I think he's retired from being a county court judge. He served quite a few years, though.
Oh, okay.
But... Now, we were talking earlier about you having grown up in Houston. I grew up in Houston myself.
Yeah.
I'm from the north side. You're from the north side.
Yes.
So tell me about how things were for Carl Brunton growing up in north side of Houston, near Little York, is that?
Yeah. A few blocks north of Little York in West Hardy. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a poor neighborhood, and everybody knew they were poor, but my dad was an auto mechanic, and he was a good one, and he probably made as much or more money than any other father in the neighborhood. But he was an alcoholic, and he was a gambler, and he was always broke, and we had to live with that. He took me out of school when I was in the sixth grade, and he farmed me out like a Hebrew slave to our landlord. I went to work for our landlord. The landlord was a carpenter, a roofer, and he put shingles on. So I worked for him for 8 months and for $5 a week. And I don't know what kind of arrangement my dad made with the landlord. I didn't get any of that money. All I got $5 a week for was I had a car. And the $5 a week was just for gas money, just to go back and forth to the landlord's house. And I helped my dad pay off the mortgage on the house. And then he lost the house gambling. He come home one night. He woke everybody up. He said, I lost the house. He was building a four-bay garage mechanic shop on the back lot. He lost that too. He said, the only thing we got left is the furniture in the house. He was a violent alcoholic, and he'd come home The only time he wouldn't drink or work was on Sunday. Every night when he'd come home after the beer joints closed, he'd beat somebody up. I think he went to World War II when he was a young man. And I think maybe he'd come back. This is just my opinion. I think he'd come back and he had whatever that's called, that post-traumatic syndrome. He had that, I think. Or maybe he was bipolar. I don't know.
This is from the war, you think?
Yeah, from World War II. Yeah, made him. Because my mother said he wasn't like that before he went to the war, before he joined the Army Air Corps. But when he came back, she said he was real violent. And he would beat somebody up in the family, either me or my two brothers or my mom. And that's what I had to live with growing up.
So now that you, your mother, your father, and two brothers, so three boys and
three boys and one girl.
Three boys and one girl.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
I was the oldest son, and my dad was raised just like his dad was raised. The oldest son was responsible for the siblings. And in other words, it was my job to make sure they did their chores. If they didn't do their chores, they got beat by my dad. And I got beat by my dad because I didn't make them do their chores. One time I was at work, working for the landlord. I come home at 9 o'clock at night in the middle of the summer and it was hot. And I ate my supper. My dad told me, he said, he was home early that night. He said, when you get through eating your supper, he said, I've already beat my younger brother's name, Bobby. He said, I've already beat his ass, he said, and you're going to get it next. I said, why? I was at work. He said, because you're the oldest son. I asked my mom, I said, Mom, why does he do that? She said, that's the way your stupid grandfather raised him, because that's the way your grandfather was raised by his grandfather, by his father. I mean, you know, so I guess it was just a family tradition that the oldest son was responsible for their siblings doing their chores. And any time they got a whipping, the oldest son got a whipping too, you know. So, but my mom told me, she said, that your dad don't remember the next day after he beat somebody up. He knocked my mother's teeth out, front teeth. He broke my arm, my right arm. He broke my younger brother, Bobby. He broke his arm in five places. He shot me in my leg with a .22 rifle. He took a water pitcher and broke it over my twin brother's head that required stitches. I mean, he was a very violent man, and he got drunk every night. That's what my childhood was about.
Now, you mentioned that you had a car.
Yeah. When I was 12 or 13, yeah. I bought it for my dad, 1951 Ford. And the first day, my dad took me out of school. He said, you're going to work for Mr. Mays. That was the landlord. I knew where he lived. I told him, Dad, I don't have enough gas to get over there and get back. My car's going to run out of gas. Can I borrow a dollar? And he said, no. He said, you walk to work. So I walked, it was about 5 miles. The landlord lived way over off of North Main. We lived way over in West Hardy. So I had to get up real early and walk to work. I got there about 30 minutes late. And the landlord, I said, I've got a car, but my dad wouldn't give me a dollar for gas. So he told me, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $5 a week for gas, but don't tell your dad I did it. So actually I was working for $5 a week just for gas money. And that was my childhood.
Now, our ages are not, we're near the same age. Well, I'm 70 and you'll soon be 78.
Yes.
But as I recall, $5 in gasoline was a lot of gasoline back then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
How much the gasoline cost? I remember being less than 20. I remember being 19 cents a gallon.
Sure, I do too. Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. It was cheap, and $5 was gas money for the week. Because sometimes we had to work 6 days a week. Sometimes we had to work on Saturday. Yeah.
So you worked for the landlord.
Yes.
And he paid you $5 a week, primarily for gasoline.
Yes.
Did you receive any other compensation for that work that you did for the landlord?
Well, I didn't have lunch, and he started bringing two sandwiches, and he would bring like two bananas. He'd give me a sandwich and a banana, or a sandwich and an orange, or a sandwich and an apple. And
but the landlord paid your dad then, I assume, for your
yes,
work?
Yes, he was taking money off the mortgage for the house. Boy, I don't know how much, because they never discussed that with me.
Okay.
I worked for him 8 months, and finally my dad said, well, the house is paid for now, you know, so I quit that job and I went to work for a service station right there on East Hardy, a FINA station.
FINA?
Yeah, right there on Hopper Road and East Hardy.
Hopper Road and East Hardy?
Yes.
Okay.
Used to be a FINA station there on the corner.
So you had a job doing that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you've been here for 30 plus years?
Yes.
Anything you want to let the public know from your perspective regarding your getting here and the time that you've been here? Is there anything you want to let the public know?
You mean about my case?
About whatever you want to talk about. Anything that you have to say that you think would be helpful to anyone listening to this program or watching this on the internet. Any advice?
Well,
or any observations?
Sure, I'd like to say, if I could, I'd like to say something about the shootout between me and Officer Irby.
Go right ahead.
Okay. The jury has never heard this because they've never heard the truth about what really happened that day. And here's what happened. Irby was a police officer, motorcycle police officer, and he came off the freeway and he stopped at the red light. We were there at the red light too on Airline. And we left, and he just wanted to kill a few minutes. I've ridden a motorcycle before, and I know how it is in Houston traffic. You got to take a break from smelling those exhaust fumes from cars, and that's what he was doing. So he just decided to harass us. So he pulled the driver of the car over, and the driver got out of the car, and he told the officer, he said, the battery is dead. He said, we had to jump it out. He said, can I leave the motor running? The officer said, yes. So they're standing at the back of the car talking for a few minutes. And he asked the driver, the policeman asked the driver, do you have driver's license? And he said, no. So the officer said, well, you can't drive the car. He said, but if the passenger has got driver's license, he said, I'll let him drive it. So he came up to the driver's door of the car, and he asked me, he said, I can't let him drive the car. He don't have driver's license. You can drive the car if you got driver's license. I said, I don't have driver's license either. So he said, I can't let either one of you drive the car. He said, I've got to call a wrecker and get the car towed. And I said, well, if you're going to tow the car, I don't live but 5 or 6 blocks from here. Can I go? He told me, yeah, hit the road because I'm going to get the car towed. So he goes back to the back of the car to tell the driver that he's going to tow the car because I don't have driver's license either. So when I seen him walk back there to the back of the car to talk to the driver, I reached under the seat and picked my gun up and stuck it in my belt, right where my belt buckle's at. Now, I've got a white shirt on. I didn't have time to pull it out and pull my shirt over the gun. I stepped out of the car and just started walking away with my back to these guys. They're standing about 2 feet apart at the back of the car. And when the police officer told the driver that he was going to tow the car, this guy went ballistic. And he starts yelling and screaming at the policeman. So the policeman starts yelling and screaming back at him too, which didn't have nothing to do with me. I'm walking away. So I hear him yell at the police officer. He said, well, where the hell is he going? The police officer said, he's going home. So he yelled, the driver yelled at me, "Hey, don't leave that gun in my car." I mean, he was so mad, he just wasn't using his head. Why would I leave a gun in his car if it's going to be towed, if I can go home? I mean, he just wasn't using his head. And this guy had been to prison, state prison and federal prison before. I mean, you know, so. I mean, that just made my head explode when he said that, you know. So the police officer yelled at me. He said, "Hey, come back here." So I said, "Well, okay, I'm going to get arrested." So I turned around and walked back and stopped about 10 feet in front of a police officer. And I had my hands down at my side, and I was surrendering. And I've been arrested many times, and a policeman pulls his gun, they have to tell you what they want you to do. This guy didn't say one word. He just dropped a little pad that he had in his hand, and he went into a combat stance. And he was pulling his gun. He had a quick draw holster. He was pulling his gun out of the holster as he went into a combat stance. And then he starts sliding over to his left. And he did this quick. And I've seen police officers and SWAT teams and everybody in real life do the same thing. Go into a combat stance, pull their gun. They would have a silhouette target, and they would shoot that silhouette target three times. Then they'd stand up and do it again over and over and over again. One time they'll slide to the left, next time they'll slide to the right. So when he pulled his gun, when he got both hands on the gun and was bringing it up to shoot me, I knew it was fish or cut bait. So I pulled my gun out of my belt and I heard a gunshot. The first gunshot I heard, I thought the officer shot at me. I ducked down. We're at the back of the car, standing about 10 feet apart. I ducked down and run from the officer because I thought he shot at me. Now, by the time I got to the front of the car, I told myself, I can't outrun no bullet. If I try to outrun him, I know he'll shoot me in the back. So I ran all the way around the car, and I saw him rolling around on the ground, so I shot at him a couple of times. Now, did he shoot at me at the same time I shot at him? Maybe. I don't know. But the testimony of other police officers, they said that his gun had never been fired. For the first shot hit the police officer in the forehead and slanted downward, which proves he was in a combat stance because his head was below the level of my gun. You know, but we knew it was a foregone conclusion because of the jury makeup, because the foreman of the jury was a retired police officer. And he was a jury boss, and he was not going to let me get away. I mean, somebody that's been to prison as many times as I have, there's no such thing, really, in reality, as self-defense against a police officer. And every time someone interviewed me, they said, "Well, if you had it to do all over again, would you shoot the police officer?" And I'd tell them, would I defend myself in self-defense? Absolutely. And I told one, I said, even a sparrow, a bird, if you grab that bird, that bird's going to defend himself. He'll bite you. You know, and basically, that's the way it happened. And I ran away, and about a block away from the shooting, and I surrendered.
Okay, so Carl Wayne Bunton, that's, you got to tell your story, and you said that your advice would be, leave your guns at home.
Leave your, just like Johnny Cash said in that song, "Don't take your gun to town, son, leave your gun at home." Yes.
Well, that's about our time, Mr. Bunton.
Yes.
I'm glad you're able to talk to us, and I hope we never have to air this interview.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Afternoon, morning.
You have a good one.
Take care now.
All right.
Bye.
That was a final interview with Carl Bunton, heard here in its entirety, unedited and uncut. Thank you, Larry, for that interview. This will be archived on the Execution Watch and Houston Media Source websites as a final message from the man who now lays dead in Huntsville, Texas. And from a last message to a first message, former Texas death row prisoner Clinton Young has been released from custody nearly 20 years after being sentenced to death for a double murder he has consistently said he did not commit. And he is joining us now live for his first execution, for his first interview. Clinton, thank you for joining us so much.
Hey,
is this the first Texas execution that's actually been happening since you were released?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Last one I seen, unfortunately, was Rick Rhodes.
Right.
And that was in September. Due to the Supreme Court's rulings on the chaplaincy issue, they pretty much slowed down. But yeah, this is the first one with CB.
How does it feel?
Guys, can you hear me?
Hey, answer Yancey real quick. So.
Hi, Yancey.
Hi, the witnesses, Danny and Linda have come out and they are crossing right now.
So they're coming in.
As we're speaking.
Thank you.
So the execution has taken place.
I really appreciate Yancey, and please go and talk to them. I'm sure that they need your support at this time.
They haven't crossed the street yet. They're doing that right now as we're speaking.
So as we say, if you're not familiar with what happens here in Texas, the executions of Texas prisoners do happen in the Huntsville Walls unit. And as the witnesses come back, we know that the execution has taken place. Our reporter, Yancey Baldeveres, has said that they have come back. If you don't mind, Clinton, we do have a few minutes, and I'm really very interested to know what's happening with you and how it must feel at this time.
Yeah, it all produces a wide range of emotions, and everybody always asks me how I felt since I got out, and it wasn't really till Easter, ironically, when I was able to visit my mother's house for the first time, that it really, like, I was looking out, watching my nephews play, and then looking out over this field, and I looked at my little sister next to me, and I said, damn, they almost killed me.
Right.
And so, this execution coming up, it drives home the reality of, like, it's kind of hard to put into words, right? Like I said, I've been...
Did you know Carl?
Yes, I did. I knew Carl, right? He was a cool dude, right? He stayed to himself. He liked to play chess. He wasn't a threat to nobody. He wasn't assaulting officers. He wasn't the worst of the worst that the death penalty is supposed to be reserved for. But once again, it just shows it's all about who the victim is. You know, there's a...
Well, you were in jail with him. Did you ever feel like he was a present danger to you?
No. I was one of the interesting thing is I was one of the primary troublemakers for most of my time there. And here I am out in the free world, you know what I mean? It shows the absurdity of the death penalty. I mean, it really is. Like, you know, I said it before that, you know, it's not about who you are. It's about who you kill. You know, there's people getting killed every day in the inner city. You know, it's probably 300 or 400 people in Houston.
Right.
They don't get, there ain't 300 cops out there. The pigs ain't out there revving up their motorcycles and stuff, celebrating a person's demise.
Right.
Which, you know, those kind of displays, it truly drives home the mindset of why people look at the police with this us versus them mindset.
Right.
Because that's how they act. You know, like I said, they're not there for the 6-year little girl that was killed or any of these other cases that people get executed, but they show up in force, from all over the state for police officers, you know, and rev up their motorcycles and all this other stuff just to drown out a person's last statement. You know, that shows their mindset. That shows something. I mean, it really shows, like, what's going on in their mind that they would do that, that they would drive all the way across the state just to rev up motorcycles and car engines and talk on bullhorns to blare out a man's last statement. He's already dying.
Right.
You know, I mean, anyways, but.
Hey, Clinton, what kept you going all those years? I mean, what was it that kept you hoping?
Well, it's just the belief that I could win. You know, I believed if I fought hard enough, I could win. I mean, and there's one thing that nobody could take from me, nobody say that I didn't do, and that was fight. And so I'd wake up thinking about it, and I'd go to sleep thinking about it. I never gave up. And, you know, my effort paid off, right? But, you know, my journey's not over with. My fight's not over with.
Right.
But, again, you know, it's you know, like I tell, when I was telling people, explaining to you, I had two of my coworkers in the room with me. One of them had been to prison before.
Right.
And I asked them to come, like, sit down and like, watch the execution watch. Because so many people, you know, they say the death penalty is supposed to be a deterrent. And here they are, they killed this old man today. But, like, most people, even people in prison, they don't know nothing about the death penalty. They don't know what all crimes you get the death penalty for. They don't know when people are executed. You know, so how can it be a deterrent when the general public is ignorant to the dynamics of the death penalty?
Yeah. Clinton, let me ask you one more question. Do you believe you were denied your due process rights to a fair judge?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, just like, you know, what Carl's case, Randy Halpern's case, and many other people's cases, you know, the court tries to sit here and tries to find excuses for what judges and prosecutors do. And I was listening, when I tuned in, I was a little bit late because I like that guy working and had to wash up.
We're lucky to get you.
But Oh, no. I'm trying to be here every time, right?
Thank you.
But yeah, I got to. I mean, I fought the system too hard down there. I ain't going to stop now. But, you know, I was listening to Larry Douglas, and he was talking about mitigation. And I understand, because that's what they always say in Texas. They say mitigation, mitigation, mitigation. And my lawyers told me that they said the same thing. I was like, man, why y'all focus on punishment phase? Why not focus all this time and money and energy on my guilt innocent phase?
Elizabeth, sorry.
And they said, look, Linda's this is here. Texas.
Linda's here.
Yeah. Excuse me, Clinton.
We just got out of the execution chamber, and he died very peacefully. He just was sad.
Any last words, Linda?
Huh?
Were there any last words, Linda?
Well, he said a lot of words. Yay. So, yes, and they did not cut him off. So I can't even remember everything you said, but it was a wonderful, wonderful talk.
So you could hear it.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you, Linda.
I'm there.
Thank you for being there for him.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you for my show.
Thank you. Thank you, darling. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Clinton, may I call you Clint? Hello?
I know. I just want to say to Margaret. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Hey, yeah, I just want to say this because... And I don't know what Mr. Douglas's extent is on actually having to participate in death penalty trials or whatever. I mean, I know he's a lawyer, but my lawyers told me this is Texas. If we get you life, it's a win. I was sent to death row for a crime that wasn't even critical crime scenes in my case were never even investigated. I mean, there's no forensics, no DNA, no gunshot residue, no confession, nothing. Just me running from the police and some snitches. And so had they focused on my guilt innocence, then I might not even ended up on death row. But that's this mindset, and that's what they teach these lawyers. And like in University of Texas, for example, they have mitigation clinics. And so they put all this time and energy in mitigation. And it's like, I know dudes on death row share my frustration. It's mitigation, mitigation, mitigation. That's all these lawyers talk about. Right. And there's only been, I can think of maybe two or three people. Tyrone Armstrong, Gabriel Gonzalez, I think there's another one possibly, that's ever won on mitigation. So for us on death row, that's just wishful thinking.
Well, Clinton,
I mean, there's been dudes.
I really want to continue this conversation, but we're about to finish our show here.
Okay, yeah, I just
Can we get back in touch with you and continue this conversation?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like I said, yeah, I ain't got no problem. Like I said, as long as it doesn't conflict with my work schedule.
All right, Clinton. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And glad you're back.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Take care.
All right, take care, too.
It's been kind of an interesting show today. Is Mike Gillespie there? Does he have any final words? I'm going to say no. If you're new to Execution Watch, please remember that you can always find our information on Execution Watch, or these shows are actually archived in the Houston Media Source website. So please feel free to take yourself a chance to have a little read on all of those things. It's a great show, Mr. Douglas.
It's been a while since we've had to do one of these.
Right.
And I know none of us enjoy having to do this broadcast. We're hoping that at some point we're going to reach the point where we stop doing them altogether.
Do you think we're getting closer?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely not. Now, how soon we'll get there, I just don't know. But little things like when Clint just mentioned a minute ago about the guilt-innocence phase, that is something that you know, when you have the Innocence Project doing things,
right.
it makes you know we need to look at every phase of the trial, every
awesome.
Phase of the proceeding. Absolutely.
Well, it's time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us next week on April 27th when Texas plans to usher Melissa Lucio into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing live. We welcome your opinions. Please find us on Facebook or Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org, where you can also get on our mailing list. A special thanks to our guest, Clinton Young, our panel, Larry Douglas, and our Death House reporter, Yancy Balderas, executive producer, Elizabeth Stein, Pacific executive producer and technical advisor, Otis McClay, KPFT operations manager, Howard Reynolds, and Houston Media Source technical producer, Mark Pirtle. All day music. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.